Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And as usual, we're going to take up subjects related to intelligent medicine, the best of natural therapies, and the best of high-tech medicine. On today's podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between salt and high blood pressure, and how it really may not be the salt, it may be another critical element in relationship to your sodium intake that may govern your susceptibility to high blood pressure. And we're also going to take on one of my least favorite subjects, which is natural weight loss. There's so much hype in that field that sometimes I, you know, after watching an episode of Dr. Oz or hearing from one of my patients about some magic weight loss remedy, I get kind of discouraged. But there are plausible alternatives out there, and we'll take a look at one in particular. Before we get to those important stories and others on today's podcast, I want to talk a little bit about a bold new experiment in medicine to address the problem of doctors in training suffering from burnout. Medical training is very, very arduous. You have to learn a lot fast. And one of the problems has been that doctors are overworked. They sometimes pull all-nighters. They have too many responsibilities. Often that jeopardizes patient care, and it's a big problem. So in the interest of, and this, you know, seemed logical. It's one of these things where it seemed like the logical thing to do. What they did first in 2003 and then in 2011, they introduced reforms, reducing the hours of doctors and training so that they would have a better training experience, so that patients wouldn't be exposed to the risk of doctors falling asleep at the bedside, and so on. And the results of these experiments have been, well, they've been abysmal, very counterintuitive, because you think, well, you know, let's put in reasonable hours for these doctors and things would get better. Before I get to that story, let me tell you a little bit about my own doctor in training experience. I graduated medical school in 1983. In fact, I just attended my 30th reunion of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And the time that I graduated was probably the least opportune time to graduate in the field of medicine for two main reasons. Number one was the advent of AIDS. There was a brand new disease that was unleashed on the medical profession, and we really didn't know how to get a handle on it. The hospitals, especially here in New York where I trained, were overwhelmed with HIV patients, and there was an epidemic. So I graduated into a full-fledged epidemic that was poorly understood in 1983 when I began my medical training as a resident at one of the hotbeds of treatment for HIV, which was Bellevue Hospital in New York. I also trained at adjacent hospitals. University Hospital was then part of New York University, and NYU Medical Center, now renamed Langone Medical Center, and also the Manhattan VA Hospital. So it was a great training experience. I don't regret a moment of it, but it was in many ways very nightmarish for us. The other main reason that it was unfortuitous to be starting an internal medicine program in 1983 was that there was absolutely no notion of reform in terms of the workload and the hours. There was this kind of idea that it was a machismo kind of attitude, which is, you know, and it's part of a tradition, almost a kind of like a hazing, you know, like a fraternity hazing, is that, yeah, you were going to go through hell. And it was going to be battlefield conditions, and you were going to pull all-nighters, and that's the way you were going to learn, and that's the way you were going to become a tough, resilient, savvy doctor. And so I entered into that in full awareness that it was going to be an ordeal. But, you know, in my life, I've sort of set up certain goals in front of me that were I thought were insurmountable. Just, you know, the idea of getting into medical school, that was a huge challenge. And then getting through medical school and then getting through a tough residency program, I had a can-do attitude. So I started my residency in 1983. And the circumstances were as follows. When you were at Manhattan VA, it was relatively easy. You only were on every fourth night. Being on meant you would admit patients. This is after a full day that was usually a 7 a.m. To 7 p.m. day. That was standard day on a day off for most of us, was, you know, at least a 12-hour day. And then when everybody else went home, usually, you know, in the early evening, then you would have a lonely vigil in the hospital. Well, it wasn't so lonely because there was lots of excitement, taking care of not only your own patients, but taking care of everybody else's patients, because the three other doctors, when you were on fourth night rotation, would sign their patients out to you, and you would have to know what to do with them. So there were all kinds of surprises. But in addition, making it even tougher, you would receive a certain number of what we called in those days hits. Hits were admissions, and it was really like kind of like the lottery. You never knew what was going to come through those emergency room doors. And on some nights, it was a quiet night. A quiet night might mean that you could get an hour and a half or 2 hours of sleep uninterrupted. But for the most part, there was lots of chaos, lots of mayhem, lots of code blues where you had to run and pump the chest of patients who were dying. There was also the admissions that you had to cope with, new patients with strange ailments, some of them unconscious or incoherent, and you had to figure out fast what was going on with them and come up with a disposition for those patients. On a quiet night, maybe you had one or two admissions. They might be soft admissions, patients who had a mild case of asthma necessitating routine treatment, or maybe a patient who was admitted preoperatively. That was a gift when you had a patient who was just admitted and you had to, you know, write the basic workup because they were going to get a planned operation the next morning. That was the easy part. The hard part was when you would get sometimes one, then two, then three, then four, then five, then perhaps six admissions per night. One might be an uncontrolled GI bleeder. Another might be a patient suffering from congestive heart failure who required emergency resuscitation. Another patient might be a patient suffering from crushing chest pain who then had to go in the coronary care unit, and so on and so on. Overwhelming infections were common, particularly with this new mystery ailment, AIDS or HIV. So you can imagine we didn't get very much sleep. That was when we were on the relatively easy every fourth night rotation. But then at New York University Hospital and at Bellevue in particular, you were on every third night. That meant you had two nights, quote, off. You could actually go home and go to sleep. But on the third night, that was your admitting night. And by luck or serendipity, my worst crisis during that year, that internship year, was when I was at Bellevue Hospital, and suddenly luck turned against me. There were three admitting interns on our team, because we were on every third night, so we would alternate. And suddenly, a great disparity arose between the number of patients that we had. The other two interns had five or six patients, and suddenly my count started to go up. It was the luck of the draw. I just got sicker patients. We couldn't get them out of the hospital. And because we thought that, you know, luck was, you know, it was going to go one way or go another, we didn't trade off on patients. There was no relief. So we would sometimes enviously look at the low patient load, relatively low patient load of other interns on our team. Other times we would sort of whistle under our breath at the number of patients they had to take care of. It usually evened out. But I remember that suddenly, while their patient loads shrank to five or six manageable patients, my patient load started to go up. I had first eight, then 10, then 12, then 13 or 14 patients to manage on my own. And what was really crazy about it is that I had five IV drug abusing, heroin addicted prostitutes on my service. Now, I was a young man in my 20s, and I had never visited a prostitute. The closest I had ever come to a prostitute was perhaps passing a woman on a dark street corner wearing fishnet stockings and rouge lipstick and walking on by. But here in the hospital, I got up close and personal with five, count them, five heroin-addicted, crusty New York City prostitutes, and they were sick. And we didn't know really what they were sick with, but they had high fevers, they were losing weight, they had oral thrush, they had candida infections of the mouth, and their white blood cell counts were very low, their immune systems were crashing. And we didn't really know what was going on then. We only learned as you know, through the years, as experience revealed, that there was another population besides gay men who were getting AIDS. These were IV drug abusers in New York City. And so my workload became crushing. I didn't sleep at all. Every time I was on call for several days in a row, and my nerves were frazzled. And finally, I just, you know, it was sort of machismo to say, I can take it, I can take it. But finally, I went to my team leader, my junior resident, and said, I can't deal with this anymore. I got to get help. I noticed that the other interns, they don't have as many patients as I have. Please, you got to do something about it. I tapped out, basically. I cried uncle. I said, this is more than I can handle on my own. Well, long story short, they evened out my schedule. They made it easier on me. I got through that crisis. But it was a very, very arduous time in my life. And so it was interest. It was with interest that I learned, first in 2003 and then in 2011, that reforms were going to be introduced. And in some ways, I looked a little skeptically at that. I said, look, if I went through that horrible experience, why should they make it easy on the young kids? There was sort of an attitude of, we were the giants in those days. The kids these days, they're spoiled. They don't have to pull all-nighters. They have limited hours. Why make it easier on those kids? But unfortunately, and counterintuitively, the results of this new scheduling scheme, they've done studies, and the results have been abysmal. Here's a story from Journal Watch. Studies show more errors, perceived reductions in quality of care, and little evidence of improved resident well-being. Well, first they did it in 2003. In 2003, get this, this is what they call a lightened schedule. They created a schedule where every fourth night you were on call. Okay, so I was on every third night, so that was already reformed, only be on call every fourth night. And with a limit of just a maximum of 30 hours, 30 consecutive hours on duty. You know, I always thought, hey, that's a walk in the park. Some you know, if you get to the hospital at 7 a.m. one day and you stay through the evening, and then it's your, that's the night when you're on call, and then you stay up all night, perhaps with a cat nap of a half an hour while madly scribbling some notes about a patient, and then you stay up through the entire consecutive day, that could be 40 hours or 42 consecutive hours of duty before you go home and crash. So a 30-hour limit, while that sounds crazy, that actually was generous. In 2011, they made it even cushier. The individuals were scheduled to have 16-hour duty limits. Wow, that's pretty luxurious. That's like a no-show job, just 16 consecutive hours. That's nothing. Well, what was the result of that? You would think there would be more time for interns to get and residents to get refreshed, to spend more time reading about their patients and learning, and patient care would improve because, after all, who wants a doctor who's asleep on his or her feet taking care of you? You would think also there would be a minimization in errors. Well, think again, because with less consecutive hours taking care of the patients, there were more handoffs. In other words, you'd go home and you'd sign off and tell your colleagues, well, this is my patient in bed A, that patient has diabetes, the patient in bed B, that patient has is recovering from a heart attack. Here are the instructions. There were more handoffs, and as a result, patient care deteriorated. And there was also, paradoxically, you'd think that the residents, the doctors in training, would be happier with the new scheme of things. Well, they weren't. And what they found was that there were multiple violations of the new code. The doctors wanted to stay longer. They wanted to work harder. They wanted to hang in there and take care of their patients. There was no difference in sleep amounts, interestingly, no difference in depressive symptoms or even well-being. However, there was a highly significant percentage of reported concerns about making serious clinical errors. So very, very fascinating results of what was an experiment thought to make medicine safer. But what they say here is that they didn't figure out that what they wanted these doctors to do, they wanted them to do the same amount of work in about half the time. They say the experiment is equivalent to as if you told airline pilots that they can only work a certain number of hours, but that they had to fly 50% more flights. So they had the same responsibilities, but they had less time in which to achieve their goals. And there was more confusion due to the handoffs. And the net result is that it didn't work out well. So anyway, that's the results of the latest experiment in residency training. Okay, and now to one of my least favorite subjects, which is natural therapies for weight loss. Natural therapies for weight loss. I mean, you go to health food stores, you listen to the radio or you watch TV, and you see all manner of products that purport to help people lose weight. The pounds will melt off magically. You don't need sweaty exercise or arduous diets. And frankly, a lot of that is hype. It's pure hype. It's often the subject of tabloid medical shows. And I think that for the most part, promoting products like this does a great disservice to the public, because when people don't get good results, they become frustrated and disheartened and ultimately lose faith in the prospects for sane and rational weight loss. Also, you know, any program that discounts the clear benefits of exercise and proper dietary practices, in my opinion, is a total ripoff. However, there are some things that I do find useful in clinical practice for weight loss. The first one, and I've talked about this extensively and many of you know about it, is EGCG from green tea. Now, it turns out that EGCG actually has some thermogenic properties. Thermogenic is a word that means fat burning, and you can actually, to some extent, rev up your metabolism and provide an adjunct to diet and exercise when you're taking EGCG. The pounds won't melt off if you don't do the right things, but EGCG is one of the things I prescribe, and usually I use my own product, EGCG Ultra, two capsules twice daily. That achieves the proper levels of EGCG to assist people in losing weight. But, you know, I want to share with you a very interesting new concept, and it comes to us from the world of hot peppers. We know that hot peppers make you hot, all right? They make your face turn red, you sweat, and they actually are thermogenic, clearly so. They raise your temperature. Studies have shown, however, that they have side effects. If you consume California long slim peppers, they've done experiments, they're super hot. They will take the roof of your head off. And experimental volunteers have consumed these things while hooked up to all kinds of measurement devices. And it turns out that they trigger marked increases in blood pressure and heart rate. So while thermogenic that is undesirable. You know, you don't, especially patients who are at risk for cardiovascular disease, you don't want to make their heart rates, you don't want to make their blood pressure go up. So researchers have turned to capsaicinoids. Capsaicinoids are chili-like substances that lack some of the unpleasant side effects. According to the research, capsaicinoids accomplish thermogenesis with an excellent safety profile, and that's been demonstrated in several well-designed animal and clinical studies. They don't create a burning sensation. You don't even really taste them when you take them in capsules. So clearly, there are advantages to the use of capsaicinoids. The product that I use, and this is a product that's not available in health food stores. I think there are some capsaicinoid products that are now available in health food stores, but the one I use is designed for health professionals. It's called Capsiate. And the way that they work is that they increase sympathetic nervous system activity. The sympathetic nervous system is responsible for fat burning, but they do it in a way that's selective, that doesn't make blood pressure go up or heart rate or the heart rate increase. So one of the things they do, according to the research, is that they promote the good kind of fat. Did you know that there's good fat and bad fat? Kind of like good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. The bad fat is what's called white adipose tissue. That's what they suck out when they do liposuction. And you know, all that tallow-like material that they can suck out of your belly or your buttocks or your thighs, that's white adipose tissue, or WAT, W-A-T. The new discovery is that it was thought that when humans mature, babies have brown adipose tissue, or BAT. That's a good type of fat. And it's actually designed to help heat up the body, fend off hypothermia. And it's a type of fat that actually helps you burn fat. But it was thought that it just didn't exist in adults. Yeah, little babies have it, but once you get past toddler stage, it disappears. It turns out we have small amounts of this. And capsaicinoids help to rev BAT, or BAT fat, brown adipose tissue. So some of their physiologic effects that have been documented in research, most of this research, by the way, done in Japan, because this is a Japanese invention by a big Japanese company called Ajinomoto. They make a lot of amino acids, and they make, I mean, it's a huge industrial company. And they have a branch that looks for useful health products. They have documented in their research the multiple biologic effects of capsaicinoids, which include increased oxygen consumption. That's good because it's a fat-burning process. The elevation of body temperature, but not to the point where you feel sweaty or hot, but you know, anything that elevates your body temperature will be thermogenic. Increased energy expenditure and reduced fat accumulation. They started the research with mice. Mice treated for 2 weeks with capsaicinoids showed increased metabolic rates, higher oxygen consumption, and increased carbohydrate and fat oxidation at rest. So that's pretty cool. Also, the researchers looked at humans, 48 Japanese subjects with a BMI greater than 23. I guess that's what they consider obese over there. A BMI that's greater than 23 is... it's pretty good. I mean, you know, if here the cutoff for overweight is 25, and I think personally, I think I've got a BMI of 24, so maybe I would be considered overweight in Japan. But they gave a 4-week course of daily treatment with capsaicinoids to 48 Japanese subjects whose BMI was greater than 23. Well, I guess they didn't bother with people who were super skinny, so these people were fairly normal weight. And what they found was that there were increases in oxygen consumption, just like in the mice, resting energy expenditure, respiratory quotient, which is an important measure of metabolism, glucose oxidation, that means, you know, using up sugar, and also fat oxidation, which is what we're looking for, which is literally burning fat. So that is very cool. The research, I think, is good. The product is safe. Clinical research on capsaicinoids is ongoing. But so far, it's got a unique mechanism of action and an excellent safety profile. And there are beneficial physiologic effects. And that's why I'm a believer in use of capsaicinoids. In particular, I use a product called Capsiate with my patients. The dosage, I mean, you don't have to take handfuls of the stuff. Generally, I have patients take one capsule three times daily. And also, what I also have noticed, and some of the research suggests, is that there's a little bit of an appetite suppressant effect when you take this stuff. It's interesting. I've actually used it. Some of the people in my office, some of my office staff have said, hey, great, you know, let me try it. And I said, sure, you know, give it a shot. And they've been able to lose weight. And they also say that they're a little bit more equanimous when it comes to foods. You know, they can take it or leave it when they're taking capsaicinoids, in particular the product Capsiate. So Capsiate Natura is the name of the product. Find it via a health professional because it's not yet readily available in stores. Okay, next we're going to take a look at the contention that sodium restriction is the key to management of high blood pressure. There's a great deal of controversy about this, and I have to say that, you know, it's one of those things where a lot of people in the public would say, make up your mind, you know, should we restrict salt or not? And the answer is, it depends. There are some people who are exquisitely salt sensitive. On a lower sodium diet, their blood pressure goes down. However, there are actually some studies that suggest that for certain people, that if they restrict sodium, their body reacts by clamping down their blood vessels and their blood, paradoxically, their blood pressure will go up. I think it's a disservice to the overall public to tell everyone to restrict sodium. There's some people who are walking around with very low blood pressure. They're very de-energized and lackluster when they don't have adequate sodium in their diet. Although there many people virtuously follow a very low sodium diet, but it's to their detriment. So if you've got a medical condition where you're taking a diuretic, for example, you really need to restrict sodium. If you have a congestive heart failure, if you have a kidney problem, certain types of high blood pressure respond very well to sodium restriction. But it's of interest to me that there's a major article that looks at an ignored part of the equation, which is your potassium intake. And so I would revise this formulation and suggest that it's not so much a matter of restricting sodium. It's a matter of improving your potassium to sodium ratio. That ratio is a crucial ratio. And Americans, by and large, get very little potassium because the vast majority of potassium comes from plant foods. And so when we're eating processed foods and meats, it's not going to get adequate potassium. So here's a study that looks at the effect of potassium supplementation in patients with high blood pressure. Low potassium intake, they reiterate, is associated with high blood pressure and stroke. They did a meta-analysis, which is a study of studies. They assessed whether higher potassium intake protects against hypertension and adverse cardiovascular events, including stroke. And here's what they found. Higher potassium consumption significantly reduced systolic blood pressure by an average of 6 points and diastolic blood pressure by an average of 4 points. That's a very good result. 6 points on the systolic and 4 points on the diastolic. That's equivalent to the effect of many blood pressure medications. Daily potassium intake of 90 to 120 millimoles. That's hard to translate into the amount of food you'd have to consume. Was associated with the largest reductions in systolic blood pressure. And notably, higher potassium intake lowered systolic blood pressure. So the even greater decreases in systolic blood pressure occurred when patients had less sodium at the same time they had higher amounts of potassium. So consider potassium as a way of dealing with high blood pressure. And this is not something that too often doctors ignore. They will treat potassium when potassium is very, very low. There are potassium medications out there. By the way, over-the-counter potassium is not very good. It's only got 99 micrograms of potassium and, 99 milligrams of potassium. And that's a very, very small amount. The reason that they limit that in health food stores is it's one of two nutrients that are limited in potency in health food stores and over-the-counter. Folic acid is one and potassium is the other. And the reason for that is that there's some people with poor kidney function who can actually do themselves a lot of harm by taking potassium. So they keep the doses ultra wussy in over-the-counter potassium supplements so that people can't do themselves harm. But as a result, you'd have to take a lot of those pills. I mean, for example, a banana has about 300 milligrams of potassium in it. Bananas, incidentally, are not a great way. A lot of people say, well, I got to eat bananas to get my potassium. They're not a particularly good way to get potassium because the potassium is encapsulated with a big, big dollop of starchy and sugary calories. So remember, mountain gorillas that end up weighing 400 pounds just consume bananas. That's how they get so huge. And if you want potassium, you can get it from fresh fruits and preferably from lower carbohydrate green leafy vegetables. One solution is to use, even though it's a commercial product and it may not be so organic, it's easily available, is use sodium-free V8. It doesn't taste that good without the salt, but it delivers a lot of potassium, and I have patients drink a can or two of that a day. Alternatively, we can prescribe potassium for you if you have high blood pressure because it can be very helpful at lowering blood pressure. Remember, if you get blood pressure down 5 or 6 points either way, that might make all the difference in the world between you requiring an additional medication or being able to get off of medications altogether. So think potassium. It's a little recognized nutrient when it comes to lowering blood pressure. Hunger is a big international problem, and many parts of the world, people don't get adequate nutrition. And so, we tend to look at starvation statistics in terms of, either you survive or you don't survive. But they're actually very long-term problems associated with malnutrition and caloric deprivation that even if you survive, there are going to be some very, very profound effects. And that's why I think we need to think of hunger in a different way, not just as a threat to life, because even if you survive, you might end up permanently damaged. And that's the theme of a recent study in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. Malnutrition in the first year of life, even when followed by a good diet and restored physical health, so even if you recover, predisposes people to a troubled personality at age 40. There's some serious scars of early hunger. According to this article, survivors of early malnutrition showed relatively little intellectual curiosity, social warmth, cooperativeness, and willingness to try new experiences and to work hard at achieving goals. So, think of the terrible toll of famines across the world. We save some of these kids from utter starvation, but we may have entire nations that are scarred in terms of their world outlook. Here's a quote from the author of the study, who's Dr. Adrian Raine. The study was done in Mauritius. Poor nutrition early in life seems to predispose individuals to a suspicious personality, which may then fuel a hostile attitude towards others. So think of the consequences in terms of international relations, the social development of a country, the potential for people to lead fulfilling lives, to become effective leaders within their communities. This is very, very profound stuff. The researchers found that one-third of formerly malnourished adults scored high on a personality measure that taps into anxiety and other elements of emotional distress. This is a real, real handicap. The way that you start in life has a profound imprint on your subsequent personality. The thought is that malnutrition shortly after birth could alter brain growth, or alternatively, early food deprivation may influence adult personality by increasing children's distress and wariness. They're sort of imprinted with a sense of distrust because of the misery and harsh circumstances in which their lives began. And this may alter the personality outlook in a way that is very difficult to change, even with improved conditions and better nutrition. So we need to think about this as we are responsible world citizens, because the problems of people in countries where starvation occur may soon become problems that we have to address in our own homeland. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us for the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.